Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. If you have as insatiable an appetite for health information as I do, you'll always want to be apprised of good news sources of material. As a health blogger myself, I scour newspapers, websites, and even Twitter every day looking for information about studies, links to the studies themselves, and how new information gets interpreted and reported by the news media. In general, I think the media tends to fall down on the job because of the tendency to overhype and oversell findings that often don't pan out or have impact for real people. Good news sources tamp down the hype and offer information about the costs and alternatives of new interventions. That's why I was pleasantly surprised recently to learn about a gorgeous new website called The Future of You from our sister public radio station KQED in San Francisco. Hosted by Christina Farr from KQED's Science Desk, The Future of You has a clean, very readable appearance with superb accompanying graphics and interactives. What's also nice is that The Future of You so far posts new material only once a day, having made an editorial decision to prioritize quality over quantity. Savoring the stories allows you to explore the many links embedded and see where else they can take you. A few of the stories that have been covered have been much talked about, most recently a focus on health applications of the new Apple Watch. I spoke to KQED's digital editor and the host of Future of You, Christina Farr, from her home office in the San Francisco Bay Area. Christina Farr, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I want to begin by asking you about actually the first post that I found at The Future of You, where you wrote about medical records, how going from paper records to electronic medical records, which has happened in great numbers across the United States, is endangering America's health. What did you find, and why would electronic records endanger health? Aren't they supposed to protect us, make us safer?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Electronic health records, so it may not sound like the most interesting or exciting area of research and reporting, but it's really proven to be such a rich area. First off, the government set aside billions of dollars with the passing of the High Tech Act, which actually came before the Affordable Care Act. It's just the lesser-known policy. So the government set aside billions, and that was to digitize paper-based records. So I'm sure you remember the experience of having your doctor fax you a paper version of a report or a scan or something like that. So that was kind of the age that medicine was still in until very recently, and in some parts of the country still is. And this act, the High Tech Act, which was passed in 2009, was all about how do we sort of push healthcare to adopt these new electronic systems. And the idea is that this would lead to a lot of great kind of advantages and innovations in medical treatment and care. But the sort of whole rollout was just riddled with errors and flaws and mismanagement. And so I think for journalists, this is an area that we can certainly shed some light on and try to make sense for patients and readers. So one example of that, you know, I started out the story talking with the CEO of Cerner Corporation, which is the largest health IT company in the U.S., and his wife has, very tragically, late-stage breast cancer. But his wife is still carrying around her medical records in bags, all in paper, as she goes from one doctor's appointment to another. And that's because of a problem called the interoperability fail or the interoperability challenge, which means that these records cannot be easily shared among hospitals. So that was sort of the problem that she faced, is there wasn't, you know, with a click of a button, you couldn't pull all of her records into one place. She had to have them printed out, and she had to put them into bags and bring them into her physician. So the story sort of started with that, and eventually sort of covered the government funding, and why are we still in this position? Why aren't things better 5 or 6 years down the line?
Yeah, so that really struck me. I mean, here's the CEO of Cerner, which is one of the biggest companies in the country in terms of electronic health records. They're based in Kansas City. And Neil Patterson, the CEO, his wife is carrying around her medical records in plastic bags?
And actually Cerner-branded bags, which is kind of a little bit of irony there, given that sort of the whole mandate for Cerner is to digitize medical information. But in Cerner's defense, what they would say is they have been leading the charge on interoperability, and they've been partnering up with other electronic health record companies, like Athena Health and a few others that you may have heard of, to try to improve this problem. But they say that there are other electronic health record vendors that don't really care about interoperability. They aren't putting their money where their mouth is because it's just not there. The business model isn't there. You know, why make it easier for different hospitals to share patient information when the hospital, in many cases, they want to keep their patients. They don't want their patients to have easy access to going to another hospital. And by keeping their medical records hostage and in one system, it prevents the sort of freedom of patients being able to really pick and choose where they want to be treated.
So you use that buzzword interoperability. I want to just break that down for a second. So what you're talking about in the promise of electronic medical records was, for one thing, you know, the obvious low-hanging fruit here is we do away with doctors and their handwriting, their abysmal handwriting. So, okay, that makes sense. Let's put everything in the computer so we can retrieve it easily. We can read it. It's legible. And then let's go further so that it's retrievable anytime. There's no paper chart that gets lost or misfiled or anything like that. But then there's this initiative to let's let the computers talk to each other so that if I normally go to Jones Hospital, suddenly if something happens, I'm at Smith Hospital across town, shouldn't my medical records be able to go with me or at the press of a button be electronically transferred? And what you're saying is interoperability has not been the panacea, has not really arrived. What's the impediment to that? I guess you're suggesting that these companies are viewing it as proprietary information rather than kind of wanting to all play in the same sandbox.
I think that's exactly right. And in many cases, their biggest customers who are the hospitals haven't been demanding interoperability, which is this way for computers to talk to each other and share information. In other cases, it's things like fees, so transaction fees for sharing one medical record from one system to another. There's also problems with identifying patients. So if you're a patient who walks into an emergency room in Chicago, for instance, and your name is Maria Gonzalez, then how does that medical record system know to send the medical record of the right Maria Gonzalez when there might be hundreds of others in Chicago that have a similar description? So there are problems like that as well. And I think that's just sort of led to reality that we have now, which is interoperability is choppy and works sometimes in a few instances, but most of the time we're sort of still stuck in this, you know, era of the fax machine.
In your next piece, Christina Farr, you talked about some entrepreneurial possible solutions, and you being out there in San Francisco are able to, I guess, converse frequently with folks in the Valley, Silicon Valley, and what were some of the potential solutions that you've come across that may actually work to solve this interoperability problem?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I've talked to a number of startup companies who will be the first to admit that their companies would not exist if the electronic health records did what they were supposed to do. So they exist to really fill in the gap where things are breaking down and communication isn't really happening between systems. One good example is a company called BIAP, and they work with big academic hospitals like Intermountain and UCSF here in San Francisco. And the idea is that, you know, a lot of this information is stored in ways that is human readable, but not machine readable. So, you know, if you think about a PDF, you can read the PDF, but your computer finds it very difficult to be able to ingest data and match it up and analyze it with all kinds of other data that's also kept in a PDF format. So a company like SciApp tries to bring together all of this kind of huge variety of patient information, whether it's genetic information or family history, and just put it in a format that computers can understand and sort of bring it all together in one kind of space. And what they do is a lot of what they call batch processing, which is where you can analyze patient information in bulk and look for trends and patterns that might highlight why care isn't really working for a certain group of patients versus another. So I think that's a really exciting opportunity. And SciApps is just one of many startups that are sort of finding ways to fill in those gaps.
That's the one you mentioned. There were others you mentioned in the piece. I'm wondering if you think that it sounds like they have a promising future going forward, but by being able to take what is in human language, as you mentioned, PDF files, which stands for, you know, portable document files, that we can read, but turning them into machine language so they can be coded more easily or, you know, scanned more easily by computers. There are other folks in this space as well.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, some of these companies are more looking at this sort of EMR, the electronic health record, and how to sort of integrate with it. And others are really just looking at pulling the sort of data and building the software to analyze kind of all of this new information. I just had lunch not that long ago with a company called DNA Nexus, which is doing exactly that. They're taking all the data that is coming out of these new genetic sequencing machines from companies like Illumina and sort of finding ways to put that in the cloud so that researchers can easily use it and view it in comparison to sort of other types of data that might be relevant. So that's an interesting company, one to watch, certainly. And the other group that I've seen really come up as a result of these interoperability challenges is companies that all they do is they go out there and they try to find fragments of your medical record and pull it together. One example is a company called Picnic Health. They try to give you online access to your medical records, which most people, you know, really should have, but don't. And you pay them a sum of money, and they go out and they find all those records where they exist. So they go to all the clinics and the hospitals that you've ever been to and demand a copy of that record, and then they pull it all together. So companies like that certainly shouldn't exist, but they do now because of just the way that the system works.
So you wrote another piece that really caught my eye there, and just because of the metaphor, but what you ask, what if restaurants like hospitals refuse to share their prices? And you, the nice headline or the photograph there is a nice, in fact, a menu with no prices, which clearly is from some elegant type place. But you say, what if that were the case? Welcome to the U.S. healthcare system. So you did a little Twitter experiment. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, of course. So I had lunch the day before with a doctor friend of mine called Pat Pasu, and he works at a company called Doctor on Demand, which you may know because they give you virtual access to medical care. And we used this analogy, and we sort of joked about how if a restaurant was run by like a hospital where the cost of the meal fluctuates based on where you sit and who happens to serve you, and not even the waiters really know the price of anything, none of these restaurants would exist for very long. No one would ever eat out. And so, you know, just as a kind of experiment, I tweeted this analogy out to my followers. And, you know, I've never really seen such a reaction. People were retweeting like crazy. And a lot of people actually furthered the analogy in ways that were, you know, quite funny. And in some cases, a little bit depressing. One of my favorites, and I'm putting the story up now, is someone said, if you don't eat at the restaurant, you die. And that's certainly true. It's like, imagine going, walking up to a restaurant and being so hungry that you're going to pass out, but not being told any of the prices for any of the food. And so I think that analogy resonated with people. And I argued in my piece that, you know, while analogies like these aren't perfect, and you could certainly poke holes, and, you know, I totally agree that restaurants and healthcare are very different. But I think that they're useful because they spark a conversation among people, and they get us thinking about healthcare and talking about it. And, you know, you just using jargon and words that we can't understand and saying healthcare is too complicated, I find that view to be quite paternalistic. So I really like these sort of communication strategies, like analogies that bring healthcare a little bit closer to home.
I love this response here where somebody replied to your tweet and said, what if restaurants were like healthcare, and then you get separate bills from the chef, the sous chef, the wait staff, and the dishwashers, but only two of the four are in your network?
Yeah, or like, what if you get the bill by fax machine 3 months later and everything is listed as code? A salad is ML6654. And I think that's a joke kind of reference to some of the like complicated billing codes that we have in healthcare that just, you know, clearly don't make any sense.
So Dr. Basu runs this company, Doctors on Demand, and that I think one of the premises of his company essentially is just clear pricing. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, so they, for a set fee, they basically just, you know, have a service that lets you demand access to a doctor, and you can talk to them for a period. I believe it's usually about 20 minutes, and it's all on your mobile phone or computer. So really the idea is that anyone with an internet connection can just have a conversation on demand with a trained physician.
So Christina Farr, I want to ask you about The Future of You, which is the name of the blog from KQED's Science Desk. How did the idea for this come about?
Well, it came about long before I joined KQED. It was Andrea Kissick, who is my science editor at KQED now. She came up with the idea among a group of other colleagues because she saw that this trend of healthcare and technology sort of coming together was going to be big, but spotted an absence of good coverage around it. And I think the reason for that, you know, I used to work at Reuters, which is one of the sort of oldest and most established news agencies in the world. But Reuters and many other newspapers and sort of wire services will have separate bureaus for health and technology. And those bureaus don't really talk to each other. So if you have a story that is health meets tech or kind of innovation in medicine, who's going to cover that? Is it going to be the tech reporters or the health? And so what would often happen is that those stories would sort of just fall in the middle and fall through the cracks, and no one would cover them. So how was, you know, we were getting these massive shifts and just fundamental transformation in medicine. And yet, you know, a lot of it was being undercovered. So I think, you know, that was sort of the impetus for Future of You, is, you know, we need to be at the forefront of this by starting a blog that is solely dedicated to health and technology. And I have kind of a background more in the technology side, but I've been covering health tech for 3 or 4 years and was sort of one of the first to do so. And so it just kind of made sense for me to come on board and focus on this really important emerging area full time.
So the blog has a beautiful look. I mean, it's very clean. It's not cluttered with ads. It's very, very readable. So I applaud your graphical ability, or whoever is doing the design on this blog.
Definitely not me, but I'll pass on a compliment.
Yeah, and the other thing that I wonder about it was it has, like many multimedia, excellent multimedia features that I see nowadays in various newspapers that are really trying to adapt to the new model, is you have wonderful graphics, informational graphics, and charts, and even some interactives. And so it's sort of a team effort. I mean, you're doing most of the reporting and sounds like the editing, but you have some other excellent reporters as well. So it's something that seems really poised to take off.
Well, I hope so. And you know, we launched it on March 12th with that two-part series on medical records. And, you know, we had zero traffic virtually. And now I'm starting to see some of the numbers that come up and engagement on Facebook and Twitter. And you know, I'm really excited that people seem to care about this space. And, you know, I have this fear that, you know, a lot of people say, oh, no one cares about healthcare when they're not sick. And I have this fear that no one would want to read about health and technology kind of news. But as it turns out, I think it's an area that everyone is interested in. And we've all had these sort of negative experiences with the U.S. medical system. And people are really hungry for information about how this is changing and how things will improve in the future. And I think we want to focus on that while also being cognizant of some of the challenges and the ways in which healthcare isn't changing. So I don't just want to be a cheerleader for medical technology startups, but, you know, to say these are some interesting companies that recognize the challenges but are, you know, going after this opportunity anyway.
So far, I think, anyway, the blog is you've done an incredible job. And, of course, we'll link to the blog on our website, including some of the specific posts that I've mentioned here today. You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. Our guest is Christina Farr, who is the digital health editor at KQED in San Francisco. She is the host and editor of a blog from KQED's science desk called The Future of You, which, as she told us, started just a few weeks ago in March and is off and running. And Christina Farr, you seems like, if I'm judging correctly, you don't ever post maybe more than one post a day. And I'm wondering if that's because you're making a concerted effort to try to emphasize quality over quantity. The stories are deeply reported and very rich in terms of links and things. So if you savor each story, there's lots of other ways you can go off of each story and look and sort of satisfy your curiosity. I wonder if that was a conscious choice or just really due to sort of the limitations of resources that you're not posting, you know, five times a day like you sometimes see other health information sources try to do.
Yes, and I've certainly been a reporter that has written 4 or 5 stories a day. And it's not easy to keep the quality up. So I think we did want to make a concerted effort to try to keep to one post. And not everything is written by me. Fortunately, we've had some great contributors and freelancers want to be involved with this. And I'm certainly on the lookout for others. So if you're, you know, in this field or you're a patient or your doctor and you want to write, please let me know. I'd love to hear from you. From my perspective, I'm trying to, you know, work on 2 to 3 original pieces a week, which, you know, I will go out and deeply report on so that, you know, when you're reading Future of You, it's a piece that I've, you know, really thought a lot about, done my homework. So I think that's why we wanted to keep it, you know, down to a limited number each day. I also think that, you know, it's we want to be that place where the people sort of check the site once a day and they know that they're going to get something fresh. So that's kind of the challenge is, you know, how do you up the traffic by generating enough content without jeopardizing quality? And I think that with this sort of recipe that we have now, we're starting to get there.
You told us before that one of your previous positions was at Reuters. I also noticed in your bio you used to report for a magazine called VentureBeat. And it seems like you definitely have a background in technology or, I guess, the venture space, new companies, entrepreneurial companies. So this seems like a natural fit. I mean, what was the sort of timeline of your transition, or how did you find yourself now editing and hosting Future Review?
So I was at Reuters for a year, and I covered the Apple beat. So I was full-time working on kind of scoops and stories around Apple, which was a great experience because I've, you know, never had to cover one company exclusively before. The thing that I loved about it is that I actually got to focus quite a bit on health tech because that was the year, it was last year, where we saw a lot of Silicon Valley companies, whether it was Google or Apple or even Intel, really starting to think more deeply about healthcare and how they could contribute. And I was sort of, you know, really focused on their push into healthcare, who they were hiring and what challenges they were facing from a, you know, regulatory perspective. So that was kind of my focus. But I realized while at Reuters that I really wanted to be focused on health tech full time and not just through the lens of big companies, but the industry at large, and also look at sort of the patient experience with all of this new technology and also nurses and caregivers and other kind of key groups. And, you know, public media has always been interesting to me because, you know, if you look at sort of journalism and the various business models, I think if you, you know, ever work in media, you will realize pretty quickly that how the company makes money really impacts kind of the experience for the journalists. And I think church and state is sort of the ideal, but it's very hard to get there. And if you're at an organization that thrives on ads, then, you know, you'll find more ads on the site, and there will certainly be a pressure from above to produce more content, which will increase traffic, which means kind of more ad revenue. Whereas with public media, you know, my first day, the feedback that I got was, you got to start thinking a lot more about the consumer, the listener. Because that's what we do, is we try to serve the public. So it's not about industry necessarily, and it's not just about kind of generating traffic. It's also about informing people and the public. And, you know, I'm not going to go out there and just write a story about how one company has raised a bunch of money from venture capitalists, which I, you know, previously have done. I'm now saying, here's this new technology, but it's only interesting in context, and I care about it if it affects you in a positive or a negative way, and how can I be helpful in that regard? So that's, you know, that's the sort of lens of public media that really excites me.
Well stated. We just concluded our pledge drive here. That snippet would have been beautiful to play on the air and explain, you know, why, in fact, it is such a value here at public radio. So we share that value with you greatly. And starting a conversation is really the way I like to think about it. I have to ask you, if you were on the Apple beat, I mean, in a way for a technology enthusiast, an enviable position. Apple is famously guarded about its, at least under Steve Jobs it was. I don't know if things have changed under Tim Cook, but
no, not at all.
So it must be a sort of a love-hate thing or a great beat, but often frustrating in terms of getting information out of them. They probably try to control the message, as it were. What, do you have any stories about how, you know, it must have been frustrating, I suspect, to some extent.
Oh, I have so many stories. you know, they definitely do try to control the message, and they are a master of public relations, more so than, you know, really any company that I've come across. And I do definitely sense that if you are a reporter who kind of writes continuously positive stories, that they will reward that. So I by focusing, I think, on, you know, one niche, which was healthcare, instead of making a name for myself in that area, I think, you know, my relationship with Apple sort of improved over the course of the year, because I think they knew that, you know, while I wasn't always going to be positive and glowing, that I would really do the work to understand what it was that they were trying to accomplish with healthcare, and that the story would be fair and accurate, or at least that's, you know, what I hoped they thought. But yeah, I mean, we would, you know, we would really put the extra effort and time in. And, you know, I remember when I was covering the rollout of Apple's new Health Kit service, which was sort of their way on the back end to collect all of this health information that patients were generating and put it all in one place for a patient on, you know, a mobile phone or other kind of Apple issue device. So we were looking at that rollout of that product. And we actually, you know, I called up in one, over the course of a few days, I called up over 40 hospitals, and I asked them what their thoughts were on HealthKit and whether they were using it. And a lot of them were, in fact, and had, you know, really interesting stories about how HealthKit was allowing them to do these new clinical trials and use patient-generated information from all the various health apps and devices that were on the market. And so we were, you know, able to sort of tell that story without, you know, relying too much on Apple public relations. And I think, you know, for them, it's worth having reporters do that kind of work as well as kind of write the glowing reviews that you so often see in the sort of Apple fanboy population loves.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I notice on Future of You, you do have, because it's so recent, you have information about the Apple Watch. And I'm wondering if you were able to try it out or some of your colleagues were, because you have one post here about 29 of the most promising Apple Watch health apps. And so, of course, on the advertisements for this, we see people, you know, recording their heart rate or monitoring various types of physical activities. Any thoughts on the watch you'd be willing to share?
Of course, yeah. I actually haven't had a chance to try it yet myself. And I wrote that story before the Apple Watch started kind of shipping. And so unfortunately, I had to write that without being able to test any of these apps. But we did have a review up today from a contributor to Future of You who on Friday went over to his local gym, which had a watch, and he used it for a workout and compared it to using the other kind of devices that he typically had for his workout. And this guy is sort of a part of the quantified self movement, so he's just totally obsessed with the self-tracking. And his sort of like overall view on the watch is that it's sort of promising technology, but maybe further down the line. And for now, what the first generation of this device can do is sort of table stakes. It's not, you know, a huge amount better than what just your iPhone and the sort of apps and devices that come with it can do from a health and fitness perspective. So you may buy it anyway because you just want to try something that's new and you might be sort of an early adopter. But I, you know, I definitely saw his point, and I think it was, you know, very fair to say that there isn't a huge benefit to using this watch over just your smartphone.
Okay, folks, you heard it here first. The jury is out. Not time to probably pick up that Apple Watch just yet unless you're an early adopter. Well, Christina Farr, it's actually been a joy talking to you. I wish you the best of success on the Future of You, the new blog. It's fabulous. I would encourage everyone to take a look, and of course, we'll link to it on our website. I look forward to maybe talking to you again and to see how things are going and what trends you're following.
Oh, great. I'd love to chat again. And if you have any thoughts on the blog after reading it, please reach out to me. I'm just cfarr, F-A-R-R, at kqed.org.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Christina Farr is the digital health editor at KQED in San Francisco. Well, that's our show for today. Studio Tulsa on Health is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.